You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate. Last week, The Guardian and The Washington Post won the Pulitzer Prize for the work of Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Barton Gellman, the journalists who broke the first stories about American surveillance that relied on documents leaked by Edward Snowden. Snowden remains in Russia, where his life and future are the subject of ongoing speculation. Journalists Susanna Andrews, Brian Burrow, and Sarah Ellison contribute to solving the Snowden knot in a special report, The Snowden Saga, A Shadowland of Secrets and Light. The report appears in the May issue of Vanity Fair, and I'm pleased that it brings Sarah Ellison here today. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Your reporting relies in part on interviews with Edward Snowden.
That's right.
How did you communicate with him?
We communicated with him over an encrypted email through his lawyer. And as most of the people who have communicated with him found, that he won't meet with people in Russia. His location there is still secret, and he goes to great pains to keep it that way.
So you knew you were communicating with him in Russia, didn't know quite where he was answering your emails.
Exactly.
And it's been less than a year since Edward Snowden boarded a plane in Honolulu and left the United States to begin leaking these documents. But he has been the subject of rabid reporting ever since. Just a bit ago, we had Luke Harding on the show, whose new book, The Snowden Files, looks into Edward Snowden. What did you uncover in this reporting that previously wasn't known about Edward Snowden?
Well, what's interesting, the fact that he went on the record with us was one of the most exciting things about the story. And I think the reason that he did that is because he's received so much attention over the past 9 months or so. My view was that he sort of goes on the record to correct the record. So we went to him with a lot of the research that we had come up with over the course of the 6 months of working on the story. And he wanted to tell us things like, I am not a spy. I pay with my own credit card in Hong Kong when I went there because I wanted to sort of let everybody know that I had enough money to do this on my own, that I was not being financed by another government. The NSA had, or various members of the NSA had talked about how he had taken a document that was, in fact, an employment test, and he stole the answers and he cheated on the test. And he told us, of course, I didn't do that. It was an easy test. Anybody could have aced it. So when he responded to us, one of the things that he wanted to do was kind of correct those, what he perceived as those misapprehensions.
So he wanted to correct the record after watching all of this coverage of him over these many months. You call the Snowden saga the defining espionage story of our time. Is it espionage or is it whistleblowing?
I think that it's whistleblowing, and I think we also call him the greatest whistleblower of our time. I think obviously one of the NSA's jobs is to spy on other countries, and at the same time, when people ask, is Edward Snowden a patriot or a traitor, my answer is he is a whistleblower, and he has brought to light information that everyone right up to Barack Obama has found pretty interesting and has sort of welcomed the debate that he has brought through bringing these documents to light.
What were you able to glean about what his life is like in Russia?
Well, my impression of what his life is like in Russia, and again, we did not see him in Moscow. We were just communicating with him over email, is that he leads a fairly secretive life in Russia, but it's one that is also better than the life he would lead, at least in his view, if he returned to the United States to sort of face the charges that he is charged with. And so one of the arguments that he makes, and one of the things that I think is very interesting about him, is because his life is so much online and because it's so virtual, he has access to his computer, he can communicate with people over encrypted email and other channels. He appeared by video link at South by Southwest just a month ago. And he is very much in the conversation that he wanted to start about surveillance in the United States. So what his life is like personally in Russia is still very much of a mystery. And I think he's the one who kind of prioritized that below the issues of what it was that he wanted people to be talking about. And he is very engaged in that debate. And so I think that's one of the reasons why he is in Russia, is because his great fear, and he said this, was that when he watched Bradley Manning face his sort of accusers and face his crimes in this country, he was put incommunicado in prison in the United States. And he was not able to engage in any of it. We haven't heard from Bradley Manning except for one recorded statement during his trial. And so I think that's the kind of thing that Edward Snowden wanted to avoid.
Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, yes. You write that Edward Snowden watched what happened when those documents came out and was motivated by that in part in seeing what happens when documents come to light.
Well, I think that there are two big parts of the Snowden story. One is what it tells us about surveillance, and the other is what it tells us about the act of whistleblowing and the act of leaking in a digital age where we're dealing with mass leaks and whistleblowers that are, you know, a far cry from what we have in our romantic vision of that, which is that somebody steals one document, takes it, and then that's the story. I do think that Edward Snowden was very affected by the story of Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, who handed documents to WikiLeaks, and then WikiLeaks worked with different media organizations to bring those documents to light. And that what happened to Manning was that he was very seriously punished for doing so. And so one of the things that was one of the data points that Edward Snowden was paying attention to when he was thinking, how am I going to go about doing what it is that I want to do, which is bring this information to light.
I'm speaking with Sarah Ellison, who co-reported The Snowden Saga, A Shadowland of Secrets and Light, an investigation that appears in the May issue of Vanity Fair. We've talked about your interviews with Edward Snowden, but this is quite an exhaustive look at Edward Snowden's whole life. You hear from Edward Snowden, but also his family. You hear from people within the NSA. I want to know what your take was on Edward Snowden's motivations. At one point in the piece, you talk about the acronym MICE, which is something that people look at in counterespionage. What is MICE?
Well, MICE is people look at whether someone is motivated by money or ego. And these are sort of all very typical personality sketches, and it's a very common sort of thing to try and figure out what is motivating someone. Well, clearly Edward Snowden was not motivated by money. He, I think, was more motivated by ideology, which is the I in MICE, and that is one of the things that some of the people in the NSA felt made him so dangerous, is that it wasn't that he could be bought. He really believed it. And it was like, you know, in their minds, so much of the whole identity of any of these intelligence officials goes back to the Cold War. And they think about if you were a communist or not. You know, the most dangerous communists were ones who really believed in the ideology. And so I think my view is that clearly Edward Snowden was not motivated by money. He, I don't believe, was really motivated by ego, because he has tried to remain in the background as much as he can, despite all of our curiosity and efforts and legitimate desire to know who is this guy and what is he up to. I do think he really believed in what he was seeing was an overreach of the government's role, and he worried about, you know, the privacy of individual Americans who had done nothing wrong. And when I say that, I mean, one of the first stories that came out was a story about a Verizon court order to Verizon to hand over the metadata for all of the calls that were made in the United States. And I think that that is the kind of thing where that sort of dragnet element of surveillance is one of the things that he found very alarming. And it's one of the things that we've all sort of been trying to figure out how we feel about it. And a lot of people are pretty troubled by it, but then no one can quite figure out, well, what is the future of counterterrorism in a world where so much of our lives are online? What can be secret? What can we hold back from the government? What do they have access to? So I think he was pretty clearly motivated by those bigger questions. And you can look at a lot of little points in his biography where, you know, going back in retrospect, trying to figure out, okay, well, so when was he really ticked off and when did he want to do? I don't know that, and I don't think that he has said again and again that he was motivated by the actual issues, and I sort of have to take him on his word on that front until we come up with a better answer.
The piece also quotes quite liberally from Rick Ledgett, the deputy director of the NSA. Mm. How has the NSA's response and their willingness to engage with Bradley Manning, with Edward Snowden, how has that evolved over the last year?
Well, I think that initially, you know, the NSA is this incredibly secretive organization. You know, the joke was that NSA stood for no such agency. My colleague Susanna Andrews spoke with someone who described that an extrovert in the NSA is somebody who looks at your shoes instead of their shoes. So it's not a group of people that is particularly media savvy or interested in engaging with the outside world in any meaningful way. And I think what ended up happening when the story first broke and when the journalists Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Ewan McCaskill, and Bart Gellman first started writing their stories, the story was very much about the issues that Edward Snowden wanted to reveal and the journalists and how they did it. And there was because the NSA was saying nothing, there was overheated rhetoric about that Edward Snowden was a traitor or a spy. But a lot of the discussion, and I think the people in the NSA felt this, was not very sympathetic to what the NSA was doing. They were thinking, wait, all of my phone records? You're looking at all of my phone records? I didn't quite realize that. And I think over time, one of the things that benefited us in our reporting was that the NSA felt that it had been kind of beat up a little bit in the early days of the reporting on Edward Snowden and the NSA programs. And so they, too, wanted to kind of correct what they perceived were misapprehensions about him, about them. You know, one of the people who is he's no longer at the NSA, obviously, but Michael Hayden spoke to us and said, this is not something where we're sitting around sort of tapping our fingers together and saying, ooh, excellent, we can look through all of your private information. This is something where if you want me to be doing the job that I'm doing, which is trying to find terrorist threats, or if you want me to be doing the job that I was doing with the Soviet Union, again, it goes way back to the Cold War, I have to be on Gmail and I have to be looking at those messages, and I'm not looking for your email, I'm just looking for the bad guy's email. And the question now that we face is, how effective is looking at everything that you possibly can look at versus looking at it in a more targeted way?
Did you pick up on any strategy from the Obama administration or from the NSA about trying to, in some ways, contain what more we might learn from what's not yet been leaked that Edward Snowden collected? There is a lot that we don't yet know. Are they trying to, in some ways, prevent journalists from wanting to write more about this, changing their relationship with Edward Snowden? What did you pick up on that?
I mean, my general feeling about that is that there is this real fear within the broader intelligence community. Of course, originally they wanted to try to put the toothpaste back in the bottle, which was these documents were out. They didn't really know how many. They still, to this day, do not know exactly what he took, which is sort of shocking and terrifying in a certain way, because one of the things that Snowden said to us is, if you're not willing to tell them that you took it and go on television to say that you took it, they might just not know that you did. But I think that what the NSA is sort of trying to do, I'm talking about one of the big themes of this story, it's not just surveillance, it's also whistleblowing. And so far, the Obama administration has been incredibly aggressive with whistleblowers and prosecuted many more whistleblowers than have previously been prosecuted by any other president throughout the history of the United States. And so what I think they're seeing is that because they can't stop the leaks from happening, they're trying to disincentivize people from making them. And that is by going after whistleblowers very aggressively, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden. That is also by one of the characters in our story, Laura Poitras, talked about how she had been She's just a journalist. She's a filmmaker. And she had been stopped at the border many times after she directed a film about Iraq, where she followed an Iraqi presidential candidate through the elections, and it was a documentary that was fairly critical of the United States position in Iraq, and she found herself being stopped continually at the border. So I think that the other thing that is really being felt among journalists is that yes, in terms of carrot and stick, that the government right now is using a lot of stick in terms of trying to disincentivize people from doing these reporting on these sorts of leaks and making these kinds of leaks. And I think that one of the big questions that people have in journalism, and it's not the most popular one because most of the time people think, well, I don't care what journalists, what kind of difficulties they run up against. But when we talk about leak investigations, with this kind of surveillance that the NSA is capable of, there will be no need for a leak investigation. You will just look directly at who called whom, when, and see every single story that's ever been leaked. And so the question is, how can you have a strong Fourth Estate with that kind of surveillance? And what happened right before this story was, of course, the Justice Department had looked into the AP and Fox News and done a couple of pretty aggressive things to journalists who were trying to report on national security.
So a story about surveillance of the public and surveillance of the press. I'm speaking with Vanity Fair contributing editor Sarah Ellison about interviewing former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. Her piece, The Snowden Saga, appears in the May issue of the magazine, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Sarah Ellison, who co-reported with Susanna Andrews and Brian Burrow a new report, The Snowden Saga, A Shadowland of Secrets and Light, about Edward Snowden in the May issue of Vanity Fair. Before the break, we were talking about whistleblowing, and one of the key back and forths in the piece is the question of whether Edward Snowden raised concerns while he was still a government contractor and working within the NSA. Mm-hmm. What did you find out about that?
Well, that was one of the points on which he responded to us the most strongly. He sort of said two things. One, he said that anyone who tries to go within the channels and complain within the channels is just automatically penalized and nothing is done about those complaints. And at the same time, he went on the record with us very definitively and said, I challenge the NSA to say that I did not raise concerns before I went public with this information, because I did some of it on email with NSA lawyers. And he says, I directly challenged them to say that I didn't. And so that's one of the most fascinating things. We got that response from him right before our deadline, and we weren't able to go back to the NSA and say, we directly challenge you to give us this information. But I would really like to know if there is a record, because of course they say they have no record of any such complaints. One way to sort of try to square that and assume that no one is actually lying here is that anyone who Edward Snowden might have contacted would be fairly loath to go forward when the NSA inspector general is sort of going around saying, so did Edward Snowden come to you before he decided to leak millions of millions of documents? And they would probably not really pipe up very, very readily. But yes, he was very strong with us in saying that he did raise these concerns before he took the information and went to Hong Kong.
And with his employer or with the NSA? Because, again, he was a private contractor.
Right. Well, I mean, he was a private contractor. And I think one of the fascinating things about the story, too, is you realize that in some ways, I mean, there are obviously important differences between working for the NSA and working for an NSA contractor. But in other ways, it's a distinction without a difference, where these guys are basically working only for the NSA. It's their sole client. He would have raised the concerns not with the NSA, but with his employer at the time, Booz Allen. So we would have to ask them.
Let's talk about the expansion of private contractors working in mm-hmm. with the NSA. You quote Thomas Drake, who was prosecuted by the Obama administration under the 1917 Espionage Act. He says the culture of the contractors is one of the huge elephants in the room. What was he talking about?
I think what he was talking about is that post 9/11, there was this notion that we needed to be more efficient. Well, not even just post 9/11, but the whole idea that government is inefficient. People, it's too bureaucratic. We can streamline these functions and do it much better in the private sector. I mean, that's something that's been going on with government since Ronald Reagan. And you can see that what grew up after 9/11 was clearly no one was willing to say, well, we're not going to spend the money on defending the homeland. We were in the business then and are of preventing another 9/11. And there isn't a person alive who wouldn't want to do that. But when you're setting up the ledger of, well, what's worth it to stop that? Of course, anything is sort of worth stopping that in a lot of the discussions and a lot of the popular discussions that you're having. And I think that one of the things that that happened with the intelligence community is there was this feeling, and certainly Michael Hayden, the former director of the NSA and the CIA, was a big part of this, of bringing in contractors to help the government do what can be considered as sort of normal government functions, which is taking care of counterterrorism and things like that. So I think that the question is whether it was at Edward Snowden, was it Dell, or at Booz Allen. When he was at those places, he was essentially working there. Within companies like that, there are sort of offices within offices where you are essentially working for the NSA. And if the NSA changes its contract from Dell to Booz Allen, you just change the nameplate on the desk. It's the exact same job, exact same office. So I think that it's very intertwined.
One thing you point out, however, is when you have private contractors, they are profit centers. There is a profit motive as opposed to being a government agency.
Exactly.
And prior to Snowden, we didn't know how much money the NSA was spending. We didn't know their budget.
Right. Well, so one of the early stories that was published from the Snowden documents was something we call the black budget. And it showed that the NSA's budget was vastly greater than what anyone really had understood. And I think it was a real wake-up call for people to realize how much the NSA was spending on surveillance, and it was even surpassing the CIA, which it historically had always been the opposite.
Rick Ledgett, the deputy director of the NSA, spoke about what we don't know about what Edward Snowden has, and he worries that he might have the whole database of requirements, what he calls. Mm. What does that include?
The whole database of requirements. I mean, the thing is that this is one of the great mysteries, is that if Rick Ledgett doesn't know what exactly Edward Snowden has, I think what he's referring to, I mean, and others have referred to, that he has the keys to the kingdom, or things that are basically the maps of how the NSA would go after, or what they understand about, say, the Chinese intelligence structure. And these are the kinds of things that we don't want our enemies to know what the NSA knows about their own intelligence capabilities. And so I think that what Ledgett is concerned about is that, and again, you know, Hayden also said to us, this is like he's revealing the plumbing of our own intelligence infrastructure. And so I think that those are the kinds of things that the intelligence community talks about a lot. There are clearly things that we don't know. Everything in this whole stash is classified, so they can't really tell us what it is that isn't there, or what it is that that Snowden has already revealed, or what we could possibly learn. I just think that there is a tremendous amount of anxiety about this information falling into the wrong hands. But as far as we know, the journalists have kept it very carefully.
Whose hands are these files in right now?
Well, it's my understanding that they are in the hands of the journalists who Snowden initially worked with, including Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, The Guardian, Barton Gellman, who was working with The Washington Post. And each of them, one of the things that Snowden did tell us very clearly is contrary to some earlier reports of the journalists kind of mishandling information, he feels like they've been very responsible about it. Now, one of the most dramatic moments in the story was when the British government went into the Guardian newspaper's offices over the summer and warned them and said, we think that this information is at risk. You think you are holding it safely, but we disagree. And some government officials went into their offices and said, you know, you could have Chinese spies across the street and they could be looking in your window and doing lots and lots of very complicated and sophisticated things to get this information. And so what ended up happening is, in order for The Guardian to continue to be able to publish the information, because The Guardian has an office in New York, it's based in London, and in London there are greater press restraints on publishing. They don't have a First Amendment, so they practice something that is called prior restraint, which we don't do in the United States, which is the government can stop someone publishing information. So under the threat of that, what The Guardian did was it had already given its information to its New York office, which was then in New York, had First Amendment protection. And the editor of The Guardian tried to argue to the government, this is, if you try and get us to hand back the just the specific documents that we, the Guardian in London, hold, it's a fruitless exercise because we have people. Glenn Greenwald is sitting in Rio. Laura Poitras doesn't work for The Guardian. She was contracted under The Guardian, but she's sitting in Berlin. Other people will publish this information. Our own office in New York has this information, but the government in Britain still insisted that first they wanted The Guardian to hand back the files so that they could know exactly what it was that they had had and they could, quote unquote, secure the information. And The Guardian said that they would not do that. But what they did agree to do eventually was physically destroy the computers and the hard drives on which the information was held, which was such a strange episode where you had people going down into the basement of the Guardian newspaper in this uber, you know, electronic age where everything is online and in the cloud, and instead they were taking drills to physically destroy their hard drives. And of course, the information continued to be published elsewhere. It did nothing to stop the actual publication schedule, but it sort of showed it was certainly one of the greatest clashes between government and press that I've been alive for, I think. And the other thing was that it just showed how the tools that we are using and our conception of how to keep things classified or make things public or grapple with this new reality of a lot of our information being digital and searchable, and yet how to destroy that and maintain it within a government boundary when the internet goes worldwide without any kind of a political map. I think all of that episode really showed how much we still are grappling with those answers.
The question of how to secure data from the consumer point of view as well as from a government point of view.
Absolutely.
You describe Edward Snowden as saying when he got on that plane in Honolulu that he was aware of the consequences of his actions and he was ready to walk away from the life that he had.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a suggestion also that from people who knew him that maybe he was expecting a hero's welcome, a parade of some sort. Did you get a sense from him about how he feels now that the full hammer of the Obama administration response has come down?
Well, I think that on the one hand, I think he's probably not surprised by the response from, say, the Obama administration, because he had made such a careful study of the way the administration had dealt with whistleblowers before him. But he did say, and specifically I'm thinking of an exchange that he had with Barton Gellman, who was at the Washington Post, and he said he was talking about where he was going to go after everything went public and where he would seek asylum. And he said, the strength of the reaction will determine how choosy I can be. And the strength of the reaction is what he means, like the strength of the public's reaction, the strength of the world's reaction will determine how choosy I can be. So there was an element that suggests in his mind where countries would be lining up to thank him for opening their eyes to this kind of mass surveillance and saying, no, please come live here. We will stand up to the United States and we will invite you to be here for the rest of your days. And I think that was, one of the most fascinating parts of the story too is that reception internationally where people are outraged, or sort of populations are outraged, governments claim to be outraged. They may be outraged, although there seems to be some very convincing arguments that governments at all levels are doing this kind of spying, and they know that the U.S. is doing it too. So there was a story in September or so about the NSA spying on Angela Merkel's cell phone, and that was met with a tremendous uproar in Germany. And then people in the intelligence community later were saying, oh, come on. You think they don't know that already? I mean, Obama wasn't allowed to have a BlackBerry. It's because Obama's cell phone, Obama's BlackBerry is being spied upon. So one of my favorite lines was from Michael Hayden saying, you know, this is an R-rated movie, this interaction, this diplomacy between different heads of state. And so I think that just what Snowden's thought about what this reaction was going to be sort of met with some realpolitik of how the world really works.
And what has changed in the months since in terms of the NSA's capabilities and what they're doing in terms of surveillance? You note that the Obama administration has introduced legislation. Mm-hmm. There have been hearings on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. But what's changed?
Well, I think so far very little in terms of the way, well, first of all, I think that the broad question of how surveillance works hasn't really changed. Yes, we have these wheels turning in Congress and legislation that people are discussing, which could make some significant changes, particularly for bulk collection of phone records. But overall, I think that, one, I don't know, because the NSA is not saying, well, that was a program that we were really enjoying using that program, and now we can't anymore, although that is the implication that they've lost a lot of different tools because they're now public. But I do think that overall, we're still at the stage where, okay, even if they stop bulk collection of phone records, are they really not going to have, are they going to cover their eyes and plug their ears and say, we aren't going to look at traffic online. We aren't going to end up collecting phone records of countries of, you know, in the entire phone metadata of a foreign country, which is something that the NSA did, as we learned in a Washington Post story. So I think that things are changing, although, again, you know, they're also kind of staying the same. It's that old cliche that basically the NSA, I don't see anything really slowing this kind of data collection. And it's partly because we live in a virtual world. And so if we want our intelligence communities to be looking for the kinds of things that they look for, the only place they know how to look is again, in this digital world.
One of the final quotes from Edward Snowden in your piece, he refers to we in the post-terror generation look at these trade-offs differently. Do you buy that? Are we in a post-terror generation?
Well, I think it certainly the notion that after 9/11, many, many things changed about the way that we approach defense, politics. I do think that there was that we are living in a time, certainly by definition, it's after 9/11. And I think the question of what will that legacy be? Certainly Edward Snowden sees the collection of events that has sort of built up since 9/11, whether it is, you know, the warrantless wiretapping that we learned about in the New York Times years ago, or I think you would add to the list the kind of Abu Ghraib or the kind of torture that went on post the Iraq War. Those are the collection of activities that people like Edward Snowden are not happy about and would define as happening with one sort of ideology, one sort of idea in mind, which is this is all a response in one way or another to 9/11.
I've been speaking with Vanity Fair contributing editor Sarah Ellison about interviewing former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. Her piece, which she co-reported, The Snowden Saga, appears in the May issue of Vanity Fair. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.